Good evening, everybody. Welcome to Theology on Tuesday. Go ahead. Most of y'all are already grabbing a seat. Thank y'all for grabbing the steps. Appreciate that. We've got some pizza right here. I think Clark's back there. But we're going to go ahead and get started.
All right. Sounds good.
My name is Justin. If you're new, welcome. You are?
Brian.
And we're delighted that you're here. Go ahead and grab a seat, move on up. We've got now plenty of seats on the steps, but I don't know where they went. You'll see these sheets of paper around the room. These are important for how the evening works because you can. We've been going through a fun topic. We're going to do our best to finish it up, but maybe we'll keep going. We're not exactly sure. But either way, the end of the second half of our evening together, we will be doing our best to answer your questions. Whatever you actually want to pose related to this topic or not related to it, you can. And Brian and I will do our best to be as succinct as possible. And Luke is going to moderate for us tonight. I don't know where he is. I can't see him, but I know he's out there somewhere. If you want us to join our email list, you can scan that bottom left QR code. We remind you when we get together. We also don't always meet every other week. Sometimes we double up or sometimes we have an extra week. So if you want to stay in the know, definitely join our email list. And Brian, do you want to talk about what next week entails? Have you seen this? It's a big big week in the life of the church.
Yes, so there is much that is happening. Some of you know that next week on Tuesday is what most people think of as Mardi Gras, which is Fat Tuesday. In the Anglican Church of England world, it is Shrove Tuesday, and that comes from an old English word that people used to go to church and seek forgiveness on that day. They were shriven. We're not going to shrive you if you come. But there's an old tradition of doing a pancake supper because most people would give up eating any kind of fat during Lent, and so they would like use it all up. Making pancakes. So one of the things that's really weird, if you get really bored late at night, you can Google pancake race parliament, and you will find British politicians racing through London with pancakes in a skillet. It's really different. But we have an all-you-can-eat pancake supper on Tuesday night that is super fun. Holy City Life folks will probably be coming to that. Then on Wednesday is Ash Wednesday, the beginning of the season of Lent, and we have services on Ash Wednesday that are at
8 noon and 6.
8 noon and 6, yes, I knew that. 8 noon and 6, it's a great way to kick off the season of Lent that we'll be hearing more about as we walk through that time together. But these are great times to be together, not only with other folks from Theology on Tuesdays, but also sort of the larger body of Christ, and really fun time and good food on Tuesday.
You're here. Well, obviously, Brian and I, we are priests at St. Philip's Church, but we have a number of folks from either no church background or they go to a different church. That's wonderful. We want any and everyone to be able to feel like they can come to Theology on Tuesdays. Who here, just by show of hands, has ever been to an Ash Wednesday service? Yeah, all right, that's great. A number of you maybe haven't. One of my favorite things is it's weird. And I mean that because
really weird.
You're going to have somebody put ashes on your head and remind you that you are dust and that you're going to die one day. And I dare you to find me another place in your 20s out there where you're going to find that same thing. But there's actually good news behind that. We'll talk about that another time, but Jesus defeated death, but we nevertheless, actually it ties in a lot with the defining decade, mm-hmm. making the most out of your mortal life. I think that is in a snapshot of what Ash Wednesday does for us. But we're going to continue talking about tonight the defining decade. We've been making our way through Meg Jay's book, Why Your 20s Matter and How to Make the Most of Them. So the 20s being that defining decade of your life. It's not disposable, as many people think. 30's not the new 20, but your 20s are actually incredibly consequential. Tonight, we're going to be looking specifically at the brain and its development, as well as fertility and biology. So it's going to be an I bet you didn't know that that's exactly what we were talking about, but she talks about that, and it's a really important point. So I'm excited for that. We have not even talked about this beforehand, so I don't know where you want to start. Do you have a place that you want to start?
I think that it would be great to start first by just saying this book is really worth reading. If you're kind of on the fence about whether to read it, I would really encourage you to do that. It's on Spotify if you want to listen to it. But one of the things that I really appreciate about this book is it's really about what makes for flourishing in your life. And part of what makes it really cool is there are a lot of anecdotes from actual people in their 20s that have been working through these issues over a period of time. And there's just a great ring of truth to what they're saying. But I think starting just with the whole part about the brain and development and all of that, and I will jump in with that because I'm an old person. And one of the things that I can remember learning in biology, because this is what they used to teach you, is that your brain was fully developed by age 14 and that it really didn't change much after that. And that was in textbooks. And of course, if it's in your science textbook in school, it has to be true, except it wasn't. And what they discovered in the 1990s is that there is this major period of brain growth and change, particularly in your 20s and sometimes going up to early 30s. But it is fascinating because there are only two times in brain science where there is this huge, what they call plasticity of the brain, where there's the opportunity to really get major changes, learn new things, do things differently, all of that. One is when you're a kid and you're growing in that big growth spurt, and the other is when you are in your 20s. And one of the things that it talks about that I thought was really interesting that I would love to hear your thoughts on is it talks a lot about the fact that the last part of the brain to develop is the frontal lobe, which is also called the prefrontal cortex. And that is the part of your brain that deals with risk-taking, decisions that are difficult where you have to weigh different options. It's the part of your brain that you would use if you are standing on a wall and you're looking down trying to figure out whether it's too high to jump from or not. That is where your prefrontal cortex really kicks in. But the thing that is interesting is that for most people, it doesn't finish developing until after age 25. And part of what she talks about in here is that because it deals with when you're dealing with conditions of uncertainty or change or risk, one of the things that happens with a lot of people in their 20s, because most people up until your early 20s, you're in school like all day. But when you're in school, there's a defined path to run on. You know what you have to do to succeed. You know about grades and tests and all that. And people like figure that out and they feel maybe like they're really competent at that, maybe did well. But then when you get out of school, there are all of these other factors and it's not a controlled environment anymore. And it causes a huge amount of anxiety because the part of your brain that is to deal with that hasn't really been developed yet. And part of what's tricky is that it develops it through practice.
Experience and practice, yeah. Yeah, it was wild. You know, I'd not known a lot of the science of, I think I took human development, but I forgot those things. Basically, 0 to 18 months, your brain is that's that first major growth spurt where you're producing these like gazillion neurons. And then you go from being just like a sponge to being able to speak from like 1 to 6 years old. And the only other comparable growth spurt is what happens in late adolescence and in your early mid 20s. And you're basically trying to figure out the uncertainty of life. How do you navigate the gray area decisions? Who do I marry? What do I do in life? A lot of that is developing, as you said, it's through practice. And I think what stood out to me a lot when it comes to brain development, she talked a lot about vocation and your work, and a lot of it resonated with people that I speak to where they're in the workplace in their 20s, and they, I experienced this to a degree growing up,
and I guess not that long ago, but like a decade ago now, I'm 37, but like just starting out, and you don't know what you're doing, and you feel like an imposter.
Right.
And you think everybody who's like amazing is a natural. And she talks about there's not really naturals. There are people who begin and they work hard. A lot of this takeaway was if you work hard, that is the secret, more or less, to anything. Remember the 10,000 hours piece? Yeah. Basically, that was like it takes mastery, it takes experience and practice for your brain to start to have the confidence and certainty. And she talked a lot about that. And you think 10,000 hours is roughly 5 years of working 50 hours a week, something like that. And having played golf since I was like 3, but I played golf in college. I've spent a lot of time learning how to do ministry, and I'm just now feeling somewhat competent, right? It made me think of a little bit of the stages of learning, you know, where it's maybe you all have heard there's 4 stages where you're unconsciously incompetent as you're starting out, right? Like you don't realize just how incompetent you are. Then you become consciously incompetent. You start to know, I don't know how to do this task. I don't know how to do this job. And guess what? That's stressful. And moving from consciously incompetent to consciously competent is exhausting because you're thinking nonstop, how do I actually do this? But then it's like learning an instrument. Now all of a sudden you get to that last stage of being unconsciously competent and you can riff and you can do it and it's natural, and that's when you start to feel like a natural.
Right.
And that made me think a lot about this part of the book where she's talking about brain development and not just pushing the eject button but keeping at it in many ways.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that she talks about is that for so many people, this whole idea that you actually have to work to get good at something is kind of a novel concept because what our culture likes to throw out there is this whole idea of effortless achievement, and these people just naturally, you know, walk onto the tennis court and are able to, you know, serve at 140 miles an hour, and it just happens, and they're just born that way. And social media has really exacerbated that whole thing. No one wants to show themselves sweating in the gym for 3 hours every day. You know, they just show when they get that great shot on the court or whatever it might be. And, you know, I think part of what she's saying is you just have to learn to put in the time. Yeah. And that there's nothing to be ashamed of with that. And that having goals for those kinds of things is really good. And she talks about how easy it is to get discouraged. Because when you have the wrong construct, when you think everybody else this is easy for, and so I gave it like 3 months and I wasn't good at it yet, there must be something wrong with me, and that you begin to internalize all those kinds of messages. And she said that you end up being defeated before you even start, and that a lot of that is not on you, but it's because of the way our culture communicates about these things.
There are a couple, there's so many parts. What we did talk about was the number of quotes that we wanted to read from this.
But we want to like literally read the book out loud to you here.
There's some of them, but this was amazing. I thought, kind of going off of what we just talked about, this is a great one-liner. 20-somethings who don't feel anxious and incompetent at work are usually overconfident or underemployed. And I think that nails it. If you don't feel anxious or incompetent at work in your 20s, then you're probably either underemployed or you're just overly confident in a really dangerous way.
Yep.
And she talks about, well, what do you do? Most of what she does is talk about goal setting, helping people get, like, how do I manage my emotions for a couple years at a time by staying in this environment? What was the part where she's talking about a client that she had who basically this person at lunch would just call her mom.
Called her mom every
and
day.
And just to try to...
Mom,
just to
I
try
can't
to
stand it. I'm going to get fired. What am I going to do?
Yeah.
Like every day.
But it's so stressful. The way to cope was to call somebody, and then that person was using their frontal lobe for them. And she's saying, what you need to do is develop your frontal lobe by learning how to stay calm and regulate. And part of it was a lot of... I mean, scripture talks about this all the time. Reframing with the truth.
Yeah.
Right? Thinking about what is
true. And she uses a great phrase that is akin to a phrase that's used in psychotherapy a fair amount, but she talks in here, the phrase she uses is catastrophic thinking.
Oh.
It's basically every little mistake that you make, someone somewhere is watching you. And they've been watching because they have been waiting for the opportunity to come into your life and say, you stupid idiot, we should never have hired you, get out. And that is like hanging over you all the time.
And then you'll never find a job.
And you'll never
be homeless.
Right.
And nobody's
ever
going to like you.
You'll end up living in a shelter.
That's catastrophizing.
Yeah. And that all of those things feed on each other. And she said the problem with that, well, there are a lot of problems with that, but one of the problems is that's not true. It's not actually true. It's not realistic. A phrase that you can also hear that's similar to that is called awfulizing. It would be awful if this happened, and I couldn't deal with it. And what ends up, as she works with this client of hers and tries to talk her through these things, she encourages her to just stick with it, to take some rest, knowing that every now and then she's going to get it wrong. And she does get it wrong from time to time, and every occasionally somebody yells at her, but nobody says, you stupid idiot. Nobody says, we're sorry we hired you. And when she actually gets her performance review, they say, she's one of the best assistants we've ever had. Yeah. And so that really helped. Unfortunately, not everywhere do you get a performance review regularly. But that helped her because it made her realize her whole paradigm for the way she was thinking about her job was totally wrong. Yeah. And the only person that thought it was a catastrophe was her.
And actually, she was the one who asked for a performance review. Because if you're catastrophizing, whatever, I think that's what she said in there, but if you're thinking about worst case scenario all the time, the worst thing in your mind is to ask for honest feedback. You're not going to go to work and be like, please tell me how I'm doing and what you think about the way I'm doing things if you feel like an utter failure, if you're uncertain about how to do certain things. And so she worked up the courage over time. But by the way, that's really, really important to have feedback to actually begin to grow. Just to walk through without any sort of positive or critical feedback is you're just going to stay in that place so much. It really resonated with me. So right when I was in my early 30s, I was doing college ministry with some folks who were just out of college. And they were in their first job. And I was like, I can't believe how amazing this workplace is. I've been in several workplaces. This is unbelievable. But they were all complaining about, I was like, I don't think you've never had a job before. Like, I don't think this is the case. And there's a couple of things she says in here about, this was somebody, and it reminded me of when I was working for this thing, but she said, I wish somebody would tell 20-somethings that the office has a completely different culture than what they're used to. You can't start an email with, hey, exclamation mark. You're going to have to work at one thing for a while before being promoted or even complimented. People are going to tell you not to tweet about work, not to wear certain clothes. You have to think about how you speak and write, how you act. 20-somethings who've never done jobs don't know this. Neither do the scanners and baristas who've been hanging out at the at work chatting with their friends. They don't know that as well. And I was like, oh man, when you don't actually have like workspace experience, you don't know these things. And
right.
So you have to fail to begin to know in some
ways. Yeah, and the other thing she talks about is it's so easy to go in thinking that your workplace is going to be nurturing and that they're going to be older adults who really want to mentor you, who are there. And that might happen, but it also might not. And they might everybody working there might be really busy and not really be interested in mentoring you. And she says, you know, one of the things you have to do is sort of get over the shock of that it is not necessarily going to be a cocoon-like environment in the workplace, and that learning how to process through that is part of how you grow in all of these things and move to consciously competent.
Unconsciously competent is where you want to end up.
Yes.
To where you're not even thinking about
yes.
it. There you go. We got to talk about the chapter that we both really loved, where she's talking about when she, Meg J, did a semester at sea teaching, and she was experiencing what this was like for all these folks in their 20s when they had 10 minutes of wireless connection a day. What did they do? And so I know you had a couple quotes that you liked, but what stood out to you in that chapter where these folks had to leave family, you know, all that was known in many ways behind, including their cell phones.
Yeah, so I think that a lot of them were surprised. They didn't really believe that you were only going to get Wi-Fi for 10 minutes a day. And then when that happened, there was like shock and withdrawal and all of that. But after the initial period of that, all of the sudden, things started changing dramatically. And there are, do you want to read some of these anecdotes?
Yeah, well, yeah, I'm gonna find some.
One of the things that is so striking is how the quality of relationships and the quality of engagement just skyrocketed when people got off their phones. And there's an anecdote in there from one girl where she was talking about how she had never realized that when she was with her friends, it was essentially an alone together kind of experience, because the friends were always checking their phones and she never felt like that they were really engaged with her. And probably the saddest anecdote is one of the guys, he said, after the several weeks on this ship with people that I had never met before, sadly, I feel closer to the people that are on this ship than anyone I've ever been in relationship before in my entire life. And largely that is due to the absence of screens. And she talks a lot about one of the things that screens do, and there's another fascinating podcast about this that I won't go into, but there's a lot of research about how if you look at the attention span of the average adult or young adult in the 1950s, it's like up here. And when you look at the average attention span in the 1990s, it's like down here. Then in the 2000s, it's down here. And then after the introduction of the iPhone, it's like down here. And people are unable to stay engaged. People are unable to read an entire book. It's one of the reasons there's such a problem in movies with people pulling out their cell phones all the time. People cannot pay sustained attention because their brains have been rewired to want this constant stimulus. And that when they went into this screen-free time, it basically undid a lot of that.
She didn't use this word, but I thought the whole time, I'm like, this is freeing an addiction.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you're experiencing getting out of an addiction. And it wasn't just social media, it was screens in general. And yeah, I mean, it was some of the reactions people had is like, we actually had nothing else to do, so we went to sleep. And I felt rested.
Right.
And it was amazing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they were like, oh, I never knew I could do that. They talked about how the classroom environment was better. They talked about how they could actually go to the gym like they wanted to. Some of them, as you said, I mean, it was like, I actually felt really bad to say this, but I watched porn on my phone for like hours on every day, and now I'm talking to an actual, you know, person. That was so just heart-wrenching to see this. But basically, the one that stood out to me was having limited screen time allows you to think about who is making the effort to reach out to you, who isn't, and whose emails you look forward to reading. In that sense, it makes friendships and social media very simple. Because you're thinking like, well, with limited time on it, who's actually reaching out? And those are generally the friendships you want to lean into.
Yeah, and one of the things she talks about is the people that were on the ship, what they talked about was that the basic message of social media in their lives was compare and despair.
Yeah.
Compare and despair. And so, and then she says that after they had sort of processed through all of this, and she talked about, well, what would you want to do with this extra time when you're not using your phone? And she says this, so there were so many different things that they said they wanted to do more, read more, draw more, exercise more, develop their talents, pick up a new hobby, learn a new language, sleep more. But there was only one thing they often mentioned that they wished they could do less, look at their phones. Remember, whatever it is you want to change about yourself, your 20s are the easiest time to change it.
Yeah, and the reality is, and I feel like this is such an important thing to realize, because we take it, especially, you know, if you're in your 20s now or younger, You just think this is normal. But, you know, she talks about Semester at Sea was like a social experiment. But the reality is, the whole world has a social experiment going on right now. And the generation in their 20s and younger are what she calls digital natives. And the reality is, that is the great social experiment. We don't know how this is going to turn out with unfettered access to the internet, where you know you're on your phone so much, and you actually hate it. That's the definition of an addiction.
Yeah.
And it was really hard to break off, but being able, I mean, you're talking about the Luddites, right, that are out there.
Yeah.
But people are now starting to realize, I mean, it's kind of like the increase in the non-alcoholic beers. People are realizing, oh, alcohol is like, it was like cigarettes. They just kind of went away a lot. And alcohol, the same thing. But eventually, I think smartphones will probably have that same thing. Now, we're not going to get rid of them, but they're going to be in their proper place, I think, at work. And my encouragement to folks is to, if you really, I mean, it's made me do a lot of thinking of like going to a phone that doesn't have access to all the distracting things that I don't want to be spending my time doing. And that's her main point, is like, it's incredibly simple. You're spending time doing things that you know you don't want to be doing. So that's a lot of time wasted. Use it better.
Yeah. And I don't know if y'all have heard about this Luddite movement. Does that ring any bells for anybody? Some people. So the Luddites back in history were people that worked in woolen mills in England, and they were really worried about automation in the factory, and so they would like have riots in the factories to make sure they could keep their jobs by destroying this equipment. But it's sort of come to mean people that are resistant to change. But there's a whole movement on college campuses now called Luddites, and it's basically people that have intentionally gotten rid of their smartphone and gotten a flip phone and are engaging intentionally in doing other things. And part of what she talks about in this chapter is that one of the best analogies that she and the students thought of was that phone addiction is like smoking addiction. Mm-hmm. And it's like if you are a smoker and you work in a smoke-free workplace. So you have this craving to smoke, but in order to do it, you have to get your cigarettes, you have to leave your office, you have to go down the elevator, and then you have to go out and stand in the alley or whatever it is. And you do that multiple times a day. And what she says is that in tiny increments, like 5 minute smoke breaks, your screens are stealing your hours and your days. They're stealing your health and your sleep and your hobbies and your goals. They are stealing your relationships and your best chance for connection and support. They're stealing your present and therefore your future. They are stealing your defining decade and your lives. Having your attention drawn away from who you are and who you want to be is the antithesis of living an intentional life. If you don't pay attention to what you're doing in the moment, the years will pass you by. Mm. That's pretty strong.
Yeah.
But
spot on.
It's true.
Yeah. One of the things, and we're definitely not going to finish because we need to wrap up, but we're gonna go ahead and extend this till next time too, I think, because we didn't even get to bioethics and
all of that.
Fertility and biology and all that, which is really important because she makes some important things. But I can't help but think about, has anybody heard of this book, The Coddling of the American Mind by Jonathan Haidt? It's a great book. I brought a bunch of stuff up here. You're welcome to check it out afterwards. But one of the things that is just spot on that he talks about, and that really the brain development and your work and social media, all these things kind of come to a head. And the thing that it made me think of in here is Haidt likens, he says, you know, there's things that are fragile, right? Like teacups. China is a fragile thing. Then there's things that are resilient. That's why we give my toddler plastic cups so they don't break. But human beings are actually neither. They're not fragile, and they're not resilient in the sense. Actually, what they are is anti-fragile. They need the stressors. They need the challenges and for your brain to develop. Because that's the key thing that she talks about in the brain part about your 20s, is that you need those stressors in in-person relationships, being able to navigate when you're socially awkward. I was terribly socially awkward still am to some degree, but like I was like crippling.
I've been meaning to talk to you about that.
It's all right. But seriously, when I was like 22, if you would have come up to me and been like, you're going to be in a room full of folks in their 20s and 30s like this and be talking, I would have laughed at you because I would have never thought that was possible. But the reality is your 20s are that time where if you begin to work at it and you're going through the stress, you're going through the challenges, your brain will start to rewire and start in a way unlike any other period in your life. That's what she's saying, is this is so critical. Yes, it can do that in your 30s, 40s, 50s, but your 20s are a unique opportunity for you to actually capitalize on that and become the kind of person that you want to be. And so I thought that was just so important, because I see so many people, and what she says, I see the same thing, just people who are kind of, I've got disposable time, disposable income, I'm going to go have a good time. And you're not adding it up to, like, what do you want your life to be like overall?
Yeah, yeah. And I think, yeah, one of the things, one of the scripture verses I love is in John's Gospel in chapter 10, and Jesus says, the thief, that is Satan, the devil, comes to steal and kill and destroy. I have come that they may have life and have it abundantly. And that's really what she's talking about in here. All these things that steal, kill, and destroy versus what leads to flourishing and abundant life, which is what God created you for, that there should be joy and flourishing. And we so often settle for so much less than that.
All right, we're going to keep at it next time.
All right,
we're
going to come back,
but we're going to throw it open to questions. Luke, are you here?
Yep.
All right, great. An enthusiastic yep. How are we doing on questions?
Are you asking me?
Yeah.
We got two questions so far.
All right, so that gives us some time maybe to throw some more questions in there.
Yep, send some more questions and then upvote the ones that look interesting to you, and we will start jumping in on some of those. And if you don't have a QR code nearby, grab one from somebody that is in your vicinity.
While they're looking that up, one of the things that I really wanted to hear from you is, you know, you're slightly further from your 20s than I am.
Yes, that is true.
Some of what she said in there, were there experiences, like if I can see that in my own life, do you see that in your life, how your 20s, specifically with this kind of anti-fragile, going out and trying some things, you know, your life has had kind of an interesting course to it.
Yeah, you could say that.
Do you feel any resonance with what she's saying?
Yeah, I feel so much resonance with that. I mean, it reminded me of when I was, I think I was 21, and I was all excited because I had gotten this opportunity to go do an archaeological dig in France, which I thought sounded super cool. And I sort of was learning French, but I wasn't great, but I was kind of okay. And I had my airplane ticket, and I knew where I was going, and I knew I was going to go for 6 weeks, and I wasn't going to know anyone, but I was still sort of excited about it. But then I got to France, and I got on the train, and then I got to the end of the train, and I got off, and there was like only this one like really old man there in the train station. I was the only person that got off, but it was the end of the train. I was the only person left, and I was like showing him the place that I was supposed to go, and it eventually transpired that that was 20 miles away from where I was, and I didn't have any money. I didn't have anything, and I was like, I'm going to die. I'm going to starve to death in this train station in France, and no one will ever know that I...
Catastrophizing.
Yeah, exactly. But it ended up, it all worked out, and there are so many like great stories out of that whole time. But you know, that was one of those huge growth experiences, because I was way outside my comfort zone, but it all worked out.
One of the things that stood out to me in this whole, like if I were to distill a lot of what she said in my own theological jargon, is like, act like an Arminian, but sleep like a Calvinist.
Yes.
Basically,
yes.
If you know those terms, you might understand. Basically, Arminians believe that you're the deciding factor in your salvation. Like, you're making your free choice to follow Jesus, and therefore that's what saves you. And so they do a lot of like, you know, altar calls, and you actually need to make a decision and get on it. Come on. Like, that's a lot of the thrust behind, and, you know, the Calvinists are the frozen chosen, right? They're the ones that are like, God saves me and I don't have to do anything. And it's like, well,
yes,
I think
but
if you're to distill this book, it's like, man, act like those Arminians who are after it, but know that God is the one, like the Calvinists, who see God's
the
hand
anchor
over everything. You can sleep like a baby knowing that as you're trying your best and doing these things, he's going to weave your story in exactly the right way. And that's the hope that I think is missing in some of this.
Yeah.
Because she's not a Christian.
Right.
But
yet.
That's what I would add to it.
Yet.
Yes, yet. All right. Hopefully we have maybe a couple more questions.
Yeah. The first one's for Brian. Brian, would you consider running for mayor?
I think William Cogswell is doing a fine job, so I don't feel obliged to do that. But thank you for your support.
All right. Advice for 20-somethings who are actively seeking milestones like dating, marriage, and children, as discussed by Meg J., but haven't achieved them yet.
Keep after it, I think.
I would say it basically is about starting somewhere. So one of the things she talks a lot about is imagining where you want to be kind of at the, not necessarily the end of your life, but like in your 60s or wherever. What do you want to be able to look back on? What do you want to have as pieces of your life, and then work backwards to figure out how to get those things. And so part of what that means is setting goals. So like if you are interested in being in a serious relationship with someone that might potentially lead to marriage, you have to go out with some people. I mean, that may seem like really obvious, but I think one of the things that we forget is there are multiple ways of making that happen. Some people think, I've got to, if you're the guy, I've got to call this girl and ask her on a date, and that's the only way it will ever happen. That is a way it can happen, but you can also get to know people by organizing groups of people with guys and girls together and get to know people that way, and then once you are more comfortable and know people better, then you can ask the girl out. You just have to begin to work on it and set goals for yourself, because I think all of those milestones, one of the things that might be important is to pick one to work on instead of just saying, I have 10 milestones that, and I'm just overwhelmed because I don't know how to start with any of them. You gotta start somewhere.
Yeah, I think recognizing, you know, even if you're trying to meet online, at some point you gotta be in person. So lean into like in-person activities. And I would say this too, I'd add, if you're looking to grow in it, there's different sorts of things to spend time doing in person. You can go just have a fun time. Those are not as effective, I think, in trying to grow in getting a spouse, and because they're not as substantive. Just having a good time, you know, this is why we talk about the inklings so much.
Mm-hmm.
What are the things that God's...
I love that you said we talk about the
we
inklings.
Do talk about the inklings, because they were after positive good in the community. They had a gift for literature, and you know, every one of you has something God has gifted each of you with that he's calling you to cultivate for the good of the people out there, to actually go and serve. Those are things that if you spend your time doing those kind of service things, whether it's through writing or whatever it is, discover those, lean into those more than you're just having a good old time doing whatever. And usually somebody will pop up next to you that is after something similar. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of what I would say to encourage.
Yeah, the other thing I would say, a great skill to work on is learning to ask good questions. Part of the problem is that we get where we are so lazy, people don't know how to have real conversations anymore. And so, you know, you sort of default to talking about politics or Clemson athletics or, you know, whatever it might be. And it's not that those are wrong, but I mean, how much better to ask somebody a really good question about what's brought them joy in the past couple of weeks, or you know, those kinds of things. People are predisposed to want to talk about what's going on in their life, and if you can ask good questions, you can really begin to get to know people.
And they'll like you more.
Right.
Life hack when you're socially awkward. Just start asking questions. People like to talk about themselves. It's like, oh, okay, I can do that. What's next, Luke?
This is kind of similar to what you were just talking about, but it says, I'm interested in literally everything, and it makes it hard to focus on any one thing. This has been a theme for me professionally and personally. Any advice?
Yes. She talks about this earlier in the book, and you might remember there was the study that she talked about of the people that went to the upscale grocery store and did a jams display. And I'm gonna get the numbers wrong, but the first jams display, they had like 28 jams that were all like these artisanal, really fancy jams. And you could try all of them, and then if you stayed there and liked them enough, you could like actually get a jar to take home. And so they did that. Then they did another very similar, but with only six. And with just the six flavors, people were way more likely to choose one and take it home, because people get overwhelmed by choice. And what she talks about in this book is that if you're interested in lots and lots of things and have trouble sort of narrowing down, then part of what you need to do is to realize that at 25 or however old you are, you're not a blank slate, that you've had a whole raft of experiences, you've had courses, you've had vacations, you may have had jobs, and there are probably some things that really fired you up and other things that you were like, that sucked. And so what you want to do is sort of build a profile of what are the things that are life-giving for you, and then start investing in that direction and realize that you can't do everything. And I'm sort of the poster child for this, because I started off college as a piano performance major, then I switched to being a historic preservation major, then I went to law school. You know, this is a whole bunch of different things. But one of the things that you have to realize is that there's nothing wrong with making choices and to foreclose some options. Because one of the things I think can be really paralyzing for people in their 20s, as she talks about, is that we've been told so much of our culture, you can do anything, you can have everything, you can have it all, that if choosing something, saying yes to that means saying no to this, we become paralyzed by that. But that's actually what maturity and growth is about, is saying, no, I'm going to leave that there and I'm going to pursue this thing.
And if you struggle with that, build some closer friendships. Hopefully you have some, but ask those people, what do you think are the things that you see me excel in, mm-hmm. that you see me gifted in, and actually listen to them.
Yeah.
And that would be one way to limit some of your choices. And to follow through, give it more than 3 months.
Yes.
Give it 3, 4, 5 years.
Yep.
What's next?
How can we use the talents God has given us to set personal goals?
Yeah.
That's a great question. So I think one of the things we plugged in here before, if you have no idea what your talents are, or if you have no idea what your spiritual gifts are, we have a great class at St. Philip's called Discovering Your Spiritual Gifts. That's getting ready to crank up and start on Wednesday evenings for a couple of weeks. I would really encourage you to consider that. If you feel like you already know what your talents are, one of the ways that people, until pretty recently, used to develop their talents is you would try to find someone who is older and wiser and better than you at whatever it might be, and apprentice yourself to that person and seek advice from that person and follow that person around. And so often we are today more about thinking it's all on us and that we have to like start from scratch. But I think the first step is realizing what your talents and gifts are, doing what Justin just said a minute ago, talking with your friends who really love you and know you well about that can be really helpful. And then putting yourself out there to try to do things that will cause you to grow in those talents.
So the way I took this question, I love this, because goals and a day timer, like whether it's your phone or whatever, I did not expect that would be the bulk. I do young adult and family ministry, but folks in their 20s, that has been like the bulk of what my ministry has been, is helping people learn how to live day by day, week by week, in a schedule, and also set goals.
Yep.
I didn't go to seminary for that, but it turns out that's exactly what a lot of I'm doing. But SMART goals, have you heard SMART goals before?
Yeah.
That's specific, measurable, achievable, relevant, and time-based. Those are really, really helpful ways of thinking about what kind of goal. Like, I assume if you're passionate about something, you're gonna care about it, right? And you're going to want to actually achieve something in that. If you don't have any of that, then maybe you're not actually gifted in that area, but usually you are. And I think the other thing was actually looking at your life, coming up. I mean, we don't know what's going to happen 3 to 5 years down the line. But start with, and this is why Lent is actually a great time.
Mm-hmm.
Lent is, because it does take, 7 weeks to begin to create a new habit, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Lent's almost that. So being able to try something for a specific season, Lent's 40 days, and begin to implement in the way you want to end up, whether it's a goal or the habits in your day-to-day life. We've talked about Justin Whitmore early. It's a common rule. It's
a great
tool for healthy habits that are Christian, that will make you the kind of person that I think you want to become as a Christian.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how I understood that one. Give us another one, Luke.
How would I scan this QR code with a flip phone? It keeps going. It says, but for real, our society is dependent on technology. Any tips for how we can navigate life without so much of it?
I think this is fascinating. I really, we are in an age, one of the things that we do is intentionally make questions anonymous in
mm-hmm.
here. And the reason behind that is because most people, if they have something that is really on their heart, they don't want to raise their hand and ask it. And we wanted to create a space where somebody like that could come in and be able to ask that. Now, is that a result of the iPhone causing folks to become more and more insecure about asking questions? I mean, I didn't have an iPhone, but I was terrified to raise my hand in class in high school and college. What do you think?
I think there are some things that iPhone is great for.
Yeah.
I think the whole thing about technology is not, technology itself is more or less neutral. The apps that are on the technology may or may not be neutral, but the key to all of it is curating it and limiting the time that you invest. Well, you're not really investing it, you're spending time. But I think that for things like this, if you've got an iPhone and you can scan the QR code, that is a positive good that results from technology. Whereas if you go home and spend the next 4 hours death scrolling, just going through and looking at everything that's going on social media, that is not going to be helpful. And it's the same device, but it's what you're choosing to use it for.
Pretty good. Luke?
I wasn't paying attention. What's the most difficult challenge y'all have overcome in your 20s?
That's a good question.
I think I know my answer if you need some
time. Okay, go ahead. I have so many.
So the biggest challenge was first year of marriage. It's pretty easy. We were both terrible, and I didn't realize that until I lived with somebody else, and discovering we really disagreed. And then, so that was one of the things. We'll talk about this next time. It's obviously trusting in God's providence, but getting married, having children, makes men, this is not just about women and their biology, it's actually men become self-sacrificers more, studies show this, by getting married and having children, especially children, in a way that it's just, I mean, you can do this in other ways, but again, it's like the 20s being this wonderful opportunity. Marriage and having children is just something that is an incredible opportunity to refine and mold men to be actually incredibly strong, sacrificing people. And that was really, I would not put myself in that category right now, but that was certainly the most trying thing. Because again, if you take the whole Jonathan Haidt, like, you are anti-fragile, you need the stressors, mm-hmm. you need the challenges, those were really freaking hard to be able, you know, your sleep deprivation with little children in the middle, like, that's torture in actual, you know, terrorist thing. So, like, it's also just a normal life as a dad.
That's right.
So,
it's real.
It was by far the most challenging thing. I can share the story. When we had our second child, I had the stupidity to say how tired I was going into the hospital with my wife, and the nurse saw me. And she was like, "You idiot." And I was like, "Yes, I'm an idiot. I can't believe I came out of
my mouth." Oh my gosh.
But that was challenging, wow. And I will never live that down now.
All right, well, mine's not nearly as good as all that. But I think my biggest challenge in my 20s was all through law school, I had worked for the same place, and they had told me that they were going to hire me full time when I graduated. And anybody that's been to law school, you know that there's this huge competition going on about where you're going to work and all of those kinds of things. And so I just didn't have to worry about any of that. It was great. And Jane and I were dating, and so we pretty much concluded as soon as I got out of law school and started working, we were going to get engaged and everything was going to be great. And I did reasonably well in law school, but I was 3 weeks before graduation. And the place that I worked for called me, and I knew something weird was up because it was the board chair calling me. And he was like, "I have good news and bad news for you." And I was like, "Okay." And he said, "The good news is we still really want to hire you to be our corporate counsel full time as soon as you graduate." I was like, "That's good." And then he said, "But the bad news is we can't pay you for the first 9 months." And he said, "The, grant that was funding your position got cut by the Georgia legislature." And so, like, my whole life just went, and my relationships and my plans and all of that. And it was terrible. And the way law school works is everybody has a job by that point, if you're gonna get a good job. But miraculously, I ended up getting a great job, and it all worked out just fine. But for about 3 weeks, it was really just abject awful. Yeah. So, yeah. All right, we don't want to end on that note.
No, we've got time for a couple more. I can't see Luke, so I'm just hoping he's still there.
This is a little bit more upbeat. To add to the dating question, what does 10,000 hours look like for dating? Is that 1,000 hours of dates? What skill are you working to date?
This is actually a great question.
It is a great question.
I mean, it's funny, but it's also a really important question. What 10,000 hours of skill do you need in dating? Or that dating helps you for assuming marriage?
Yep. And I would say it is much more than what you might think. I mean, it's really easy to go to the idea of 10,000 hours of speed dating experiences, you know, shifting from one table to the next. I don't think that's what it is at all. I think the 10,000 hours that goes into dating is growing your relationship with Christ, growing your ability to have good friendships and strong conversations with people, growing your ability to be with people of the opposite sex, and to build strong, meaningful, deep, joy-filled friendships with them. There's way too much in our culture that is like, and I'm sorry if I'm just about to burst your bubble here, okay? If you really like The Bachelorette or The Bachelor, I'm just sorry, but that is like everything that's wrong with our understandings about dating, because those things are, that's not what you want to do with your 10,000 hours. You want to be building around this idea of building strong relationships, and that's the foundation that leads ultimately to good dating relationships, not waiting until that most beautiful girl of your dreams or the hottest guy you've ever seen walks into the room and you figure out how to snare them, which is what a lot of our culture says. And that is just not the way that it works.
Yeah, I think that's important because I think most people think, if I just date enough people, if I do enough things, then I'll magically find the one, right? Actually, what dating you're trying to do, and this is what I say to couples that I do premarital counseling with, it's really no secret to marriage. This is just, in some ways, similar to every other human relationship, whether it's work or friendship or whatever. You have to, like, on some level, you have human relationships that you know how to navigate. You know how to communicate. You know how to state what you need. You know how to active listen to them. You know how to avoid conflict. You know how to, like, not control and manipulate other people and vice versa. Those are basic elements to human communication that you have to learn if you're going to function in adulthood, in a job or anything. It's absolutely essential. In marriage, it's just much harder because you're spending more time and you know a whole lot more about this person. And dating, you're going to grow in that because you're going to have more time, hopefully, where you're asking better questions, facing harder things about yourself, being able to regulate when something happens that you don't like. You're learning to not find the one, but be able to see your own self-centeredness. The theological word is repent, turn away from that, and actually begin to seek the good of the other person.
Right.
That's what you're trying to do in dating. And that's ultimately, if you do 10,000 hours of that, this is why it's so important. We do this all the time about, think about your marriage in your teens, in your 20s. Like, it's, she talks about this. It's so important to be thinking about these things way before you enter into it. And I would absolutely agree that's really essential when it comes to marriage too.
Yeah.
One more.
The advice on how to balance self-confidence with being a bragger?
Self-confidence versus bragging.
That is an interesting question. So I think self-confidence can be a good thing, but I think if you, one thing that is a pretty good clue is that if you find that you are always wanting to talk about yourself and your accomplishments, that is probably a pretty good clue that it is in the bragging side rather than the self-confidence side. I think that one of the best ways, if that is a temptation for you, one of the best ways to avoid that temptation is to try to keep the focus on other people and not on yourself. If people ask you direct questions, you don't have to lie about things that you're good at, but I think that a lot of people tend to lead with that kind of thing, and they want to talk about, I don't need to go into all the details, but I think it's just the more that you are able to focus on other people, the better. The flip side of that is you do not want to be a doormat. And there is, I'm going to slightly misquote this. This is a thing that C.S. Lewis says that I think is really true, where he says, humility is not thinking less of yourself. It's thinking of yourself less. And I think there is a deep truth to that.
I almost thought you weren't going to get to that very quote by Lewis. And so I was going to ask you to do that. And you literally just did it. I think that's so important. She talks about confidence, literally, con fide, from the Latin,
with faith,
with trust, which all it means is, do you trust that you can actually do this thing? And bragging means you're telling people about that. You don't have to tell people about that, but to have confidence is a good thing. You know, do you have confidence that you're going to be able to drive home? I hope you will. I hope you can, whatever. But, like, the important thing is humility is the key.
Mm-hmm.
And humility is recognizing. Humility is not self-deprecation. That's a false humility. Humility can recognize the ways God has gifted you, and you're able to see all that I have comes from God. And to be able to lean in with confidence and trust doesn't necessarily mean that you're bragging. If you're talking about it with everybody, you probably are. If you're drawing attention to yourself,
yep.
But to deny the ways God has worked in your life is equally problematic mm-hmm. as bragging about them.
Yep.
So that's what I think the essence of humility and confidence, those are both good things that are not really in tension, but they go together.
Yeah.
Well, guys, that was a lot of fun. We will continue on because we have so much that we have not covered in this. And we'll be around. Feel free to continue the conversation. Check out some of the books we brought. That's going to start a fire.
Okay.
But thanks so much for coming out. We'll see you next time.
Thanks for coming, y'all.